is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Annika Gall from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Wall Street Journal as well as the Wall Street Journal. Actually, I have a couple of really good articles. I'm going to wrap up the coronavirus special edition of the Wall Street Journal with one last article, and then I've got something really sweet and cute and something that we should all think about after that. So, all right, well, here goes. Thanks for coming back and listening to me. I'm glad we're together again. So one last article here, and this one really important, I think, as we deal with being at home. How one family is dealing with life disrupted. In Hong Kong, they face closed schools and facilities, shortages and some necessities and a small apartment. I never realized how much I enjoyed sending my children off to school and going to work in the mornings until I could no longer do either. Hong Kong's government closed schools on February 3rd as the spread of the coronavirus was accelerating in mainland China, and they have yet to reopen. The semi-autonomous city had fewer than 20 confirmed cases in early February, but they were enough to trigger closures of government offices, tourist hotspots, and many public facilities. Dow Jones, the parent company of the Wall Street Journal, followed government advisories and closed its Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Beijing offices for a month. Employees were told to work from home and avoid congregating. It is an experience many in the U.S. are now facing, to one degree or another. Sudden school and office closures, event cancellations, shortages of toilet paper and cleaning supplies, and fears about being exposed to the contagious respiratory virus. Parents are worrying about how they'll manage childcare and remote work arrangements and how long all this could last. And we are all learning that we will have to be very adaptable for the foreseeable future. Finding the space. Living under the new restrictions meant spending a lot of time at home and making it serve as an office and a school, as well as a living space. It wasn't ideal. It was not an ideal fit. A 650-square-foot, two-bedroom flat, a cluttered space shared by two adults, two rambunctious boys, and a cat. The children initially cheered upon learning about the school closures, thinking that meant an extended holiday. We all sighed when the American International School my sons attended said that virtual lessons would be conducted over the course of each school day. There would be live teaching via Google Hangouts, assignments that students had to complete in set time frames, and online music, art, and physical education classes. Parents were told to download education and reading apps and were given links to folders with slide presentations, video recordings, online meetings, and numerous worksheets. My sons, ages 5 and 7, couldn't take part in live lessons concurrently from our single family computer, so I went out and bought an iPad and a printer. At the shop, a salesman said he had sold more than a dozen printers that same day to people just like you who have kids that will be schooling at home. Then there was the question of workspace. With no space for study desks in the bedrooms, the children have been using the dining table, couch and coffee tables for virtual school lessons on weekdays. Initially, I thought I could set up my work laptop in a common area in my apartment complex with tables and chairs after cleaning them with disinfecting wipes. But that venue was also closed by the building's management. On the first day of virtual school, I felt my stress level rising as my kids called out for me to help them as I tried to answer emails and messages from work. "Leave them to me," said my husband, a full-time dad, and I left the apartment to find an alternative venue. I texted a coworker and asked if I could come to her flat to work. She obliged, though I felt like I was contravening office rules about working remotely and worried that I might unknowingly infect her if I caught the virus on the subway en route to her home. As a stopgap measure, my company rented two small rooms in a hostel and set up screens and workstations for staffers who couldn't work from home. I spent several days there before the rooms were abruptly closed when Hong Kong's health authorities said there was a confirmed coronavirus case in a nearby building. I eventually found another location, the studio apartment of another coworker who was out of the country. It was a quiet respite from my home, but hunching over a small laptop and working in isolation for days on end, with contact with coworkers limited to emails and phone calls, brought its own difficulties. Many, including myself, struggled with concentration and the lack of face-to-face interactions. We organized several online group meetings, so that people could share experiences and stay in touch with each other. I also felt guilty that my spouse was shouldering the burden of getting the children through their schoolwork, so I stayed in some mornings to help. But trying to get a five-year-old to sit in front of a screen and watch his teacher talk for more than 10 minutes is a challenge in itself. One day, I let him paint a picture while he listened passively to a 45-minute online music lesson. We turned off the iPad camera so the teacher couldn't see him. Sticking to the familiar, with libraries, gyms, museums, theme parks, and most sports facilities closed, in our leisure time, we have been going hiking, hanging out at the beach, and cycling in the sun. We still eat at our favorite restaurants on weekends. I carry hand sanitizer and wipes everywhere, but have accepted that I can't keep all our hands clean all the time. My children have also refused to wear masks, complaining they are uncomfortable. We've had to make other adjustments. When food and cleaning supplies were in short supply in stores last month, I bought a half-liter bottle of hand sanitizer from a neighbor who had stocked up on it during a work trip to Finland. My husband went to the supermarket every few days at its 8 a.m. opening time to buy rice, toilet paper, and wipes before panic buyers came and cleared the shelves. During this period, my second grader had to use scrounge in a sentence for phonics class. He wrote, "I have to scrounge for TP." That turned into a delicate subject. I gave a few rolls of toilet paper to coworkers who were unable to buy them. One gave me Purell wipes that she had bought from Amazon.com in return. Dow Jones partially reopened its Hong Kong and China offices at the beginning of March, bringing back a sense of normalcy for staffers. Employees have to use a sign-up sheet to reserve spots, go through daily temperature checks at the office reception, and wash or sanitize their hands upon arrival. The earliest date Hong Kong schools will reopen is April 20. The city likely has to go through at least 14 days without a new coronavirus infection before the government will let students and teachers congregate again. That has yet to happen. Hong Kong this week reported more than a dozen new infections, raising its total cases to around 130. Friends who lived in Hong Kong during the 2003 SARS epidemic predict that schools won't reopen until the next academic year begins in August. It is a prospect I dread, but we will probably go on doing what we are doing. As our new normal has set in, I've learned to appreciate the small freedoms we still have and how resilient my children have been. I previously had only a vague idea about what they were learning in school, and now I can see every detail of every lesson. Last week, the boys wrote poems, came up with alliterative sentences, sketched animals, and submitted math worksheets and recordings of themselves reading to their teachers. A few days ago, my 7-year-old figured out how to email me at work during his virtual school day. "Hi, Mom. Don't forget to send things," he wrote in a string of emails, to which I replied with emojis and asked him to focus on his lessons. At 3 p.m., the email chain concluded with his last message, "End of school!" Exclamation point times 10. "Yay!" Exclamation point times 5. Okay, we are, believe it or not, going to step aside from the coronavirus and have an article from the Life and Arts section of the Wall Street Journal. A parent talk before it's too late. Adult children often don't know what shaped their parents' lives and wait too long to ask. That's starting to change. For years, Sarah Smith wanted to know more about her mom's relationship with her own mother. "I'd like to know why my mother felt unloved," says Miss Smith, a stay-at-home mom in Dallas, "and what was said that made her feel insecure and less confident." Miss Smith, 45, didn't press. Now, she's unlikely to ever know. Her 74-year-old mother has early-onset Alzheimer's and lives in a memory care unit. As significant as parents are in life, their adult children often don't know what shaped them and what they were like before they became mom and dad. They may be curious about their parents' background and choices, but don't think to ask about questions or to ask questions or know how to begin. They are busy with raising their families and jobs or live hundreds of miles away. Other topics, children, school, work, can seem more pressing. Parents themselves aren't always forthcoming, telling only the happy stories and filtering out painful ones. Some don't think their lives are all that interesting. Yet today, for some people, that is starting to change. There's a growing interest in understanding our parents' lives. Part of it is generational. Younger people are more transparent and used to telling the story of their own lives, often online for many to see, and expect it from others. I think younger people find it difficult to understand parents and grandparents who haven't documented in the way they are doing, says Rutger Bruening, 41, CEO of Story Terrace, a company that helps people create their own biography books. Kids want an answer to everything. A growing interest in ancestry and the rise in home DNA kits leaves people wanting to know more of their family stories, while greater awareness of dementia makes capturing them soon all the more urgent. Now, new technology makes it easier, too. StoryCorps, a nonprofit oral history project, has a free app that provides suggested questions and directions on recording, saving, and sharing a conversation with a family member. There are many journaling apps, too. About a third of Americans admire what their parents have achieved, but don't know how they did it, according to a recent survey of 990 adults by StoryTerrace, which pairs ghostwriters with people who want to document their lives in a book. 1 in 5 don't know anything about their parents before they became parents, and 45% learn more about their parents from discovering photos and family possessions than direct conversations with them, according to the survey, which was conducted in November. Yet relationships with parents, regardless of how complicated, are the ones a person takes through life, says David Isay, who founded StoryCorps. It has recorded 600,000 interviews between family members or friends and archived them in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. Nearly everyone, he says, talks about their parents. Someone might be 100 years old, and the first thing they talk about is their parents, he says. It's a reminder of the primacy of that relationship. Mr. Isay interviewed his own dad and listened to the recording hours after his dad died and found it comforting. Dan Ryan was 24 when his dad died of cancer. His mom died of a heart attack 2 years later. I always thought there would be more time, says Mr. Ryan, a 60-year-old executive coach for CEOs based in Franklin, Tennessee. He never got around to asking them about their childhood or courtship, his mother's life on an Illinois farm, and his dad's time as a Marine in Iwo Jima. I'm sure he saw death on a daily basis at a young age, says Mr. Ryan, but his dad, Robert, never talked about it. Mr. Ryan remembers visiting the cemetery with him on Memorial Day and putting flags on veterans' graves. I can only guess at what was going through his mind. I wish I knew. One undiscussed incident lingers with him. After high school, Mr. Ryan entered the U.S. Naval Academy, which he suspects made his father tremendously proud. A homesick Mr. Ryan remembers calling home and telling his dad he wanted to leave the academy. A month later, he did. His father never tried to talk him out of it. After his father died 4 years later, Mr. Ryan's mother, Helen, told him that his father was disappointed in Mr. Ryan's decision. I have always wondered why he didn't say so when I called him many times to say I wanted to leave, he says. I suspect he didn't want to intervene, and that I was adult enough to make my own decision. Knowing what he missed with his own parents a few years ago, he interviewed his in-laws and taped their conversation on his phone. None of us thinks about how many more days we have. His mother-in-law died 11 months ago. Miss Smith in Dallas regrets that her mother's Alzheimer's has dimmed the chances to learn more about her past. Her mother, Rebecca Bearden, was selective about the stories she told. She only wanted to communicate things she wanted me to hear, says Miss Smith. That, along with the dementia, left Miss Smith with questions that can't be answered. Why, for example, did her mother, who was admired by others for her leadership and generosity, lack confidence? I could compliment her all day, and she would say it wasn't true, says Miss Smith. At one point, her mother said that she never felt fully loved by her own mother. When Miss Smith asked her to explain why, her mother dropped it, and so did Sarah, sensing her mother's reluctance. I think she was trying to protect me. She knew how much I loved my grandmother. Her mother, she says, did grow closer to her own mother late in life. Miss Smith has 3 children and wishes she had answers for their sake. I want to know what not to say to my children, she says. Her mom's dementia gives her a greater appreciation of the importance and urgency of transparency and storytelling. She wrote a book about caregiving, Broken Beauty, Piecing Together Lives Shattered by Early Onset Alzheimer's. And that's the name of the book. And now, Journals Daily. It's so easy for us to grab the phone and take notes and journal. I do that now, and it's my hope our kids will go back and look at things I've written. Some parents feel compelled to answer unasked questions, to explain themselves and why they were the parents they were. Elizabeth Jacobson, 42, knew her mother was overly protective. She remembers being dropped off at college, forgetting her coat, and her mother making the 4-hour round trip drive back the next day with it. I thought, I don't know any parent who would do that, says Miss Jacobson, who lives in Tacoma, Washington. She never really thought about it or asked why. I thought, this is just mom, she says. A few years later, when she was in her mid-20s and married, she visited her parents. While there, she says her mother, Pat Wilson, revealed to her for the first time that she had been married before, had a son, and that her ex-husband had taken him when he was 3 to see Santa and never returned. She hired a private detective, and after years of looking, Miss Wilson gave up her search and tried to get on with her life. It was the early 1970s, before the internet made tracking people down easier. Miss Jacobson was blown away. I sobbed the whole way home, she says. There was so much to take in. Everything started to make sense. Why Mom was so sad all the time and why she was so protective. Miss Jacobson wishes her mother had told her earlier. I think of all those years she must have stuffed down those feelings, she says. Her mother and her son ultimately reunited in 2016 when his then-wife tracked Miss Wilson down through Ancestry.com and Facebook. After the reunion, Miss Wilson decided to write a book called Beauty for Ashes and hired Story Terrace ghostwriter to help her. It would have been too hard, she says, to write on her own. I wanted to explain myself. It was such a huge part of my life and affected my parenting, says Miss Wilson, 73. Miss Jacobson plans on sharing the story with her own 10-year-old daughter when her daughter is older. I want to make sure she knows what happened, she says. We need to tell our stories. All right, and here are some questions to ask your parents. Many people want to know more about their parents, but aren't sure what to ask or how to start the conversation. StoryCorps suggests some prompts. Do you remember what was going through your head when you first saw me? How did you choose my name? What was I like as a baby, as a young child? And do you remember any of the songs you used to sing to me? Can you sing them now? What were my siblings like? What were the hardest moments you had when I was growing up? If you could do everything again, would you raise me differently? What advice would you give me about raising my own kids? What are your dreams for me? How did you meet Mom or Dad? Are you proud of me? What were your parents like? How was your relationship with your parents? How would you describe yourself as a child? Were you happy? What was your best memory of childhood? Telling a Story. StoryCorps is a nonprofit oral history project with mobile recording studios that allow two people to record 40-minute conversations. The free StoryCorps app lets people record and upload their interviews using their mobile device. StoryTerrace is a biography writing service that matches people with professional ghost writers to interview them and write their life story. Prices vary on special requests, but range from $1,900 for 4 hours of interviews and a 55 to 60 page book to $7,450 for 10 hours of interviews and a 115 to 125 page book. Finding True Connections, How to Learn and Write About a Family Member's History by Gareth St. John Thomas is a manual offering steps, guides, and 100 questions, along with follow-up prompts to help document a person's life story. List price, $24.99. What a wonderful idea. And we need to do it before it's too late. And I'm sure you have many other questions that you'd like to ask your parents as well. All righty. Well, I am afraid that we have run out of our time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Annika Gall, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Make it a great week. Be safe. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. And interview your parents if you still have the availability to do so. And if not, maybe you could just have a nice conversation with your children and let them know about your upbringing and your parents and your life growing up with them. Have a great rest of the week. Take care.